on FatWallet Show this week. What even is the stock market? Hey, I'm Christia, with me, Simon. You know, I realized it's almost time to enter the Sanlam Awards again, and I wonder if we're going to get penalized for being so dorky about having won the award to begin with.
Or maybe they're so excited that we're so excited that they're going to give us a real award. Because imagine if we get to say multiple award winning. Of course, hey, Sanlam, we love you. Not your RAs.
Not your RAs. I love that we both went there. If you're new to this podcast, please be warned that a bleep version of the show is available at justonelap.com. Thank you to Sean Combrink for doing that for us. We recorded the show on the 10th of October because Simon was a lazy bum and took a little break. So we don't really know what's happening to our
But now this is sad because now I'm back from my break. So I'm time traveling to like when I'm past my holiday and I haven't had my holiday yet.
You're already pre-sad. So we don't know what's happening to our two indices, but based on past experience, it's probably nothing good. You guys can go find them on justonelap.com. Just search for Love Index or Zach One Lap Index. You can go check that out for yourself this week. Our win of the week is Sabushi for sending such a happy email. Listen to this. I've been listening to the Fat Wallet for more than a year, and I encourage my wife to listen as well. Last week, she received an email from her employer Vodacom about their Yebu Yetu shares, and they were given three options to choose from. With the knowledge we received from Just One Lap, it was easy not only to make a choice, but an informed choice. Thank you guys for your education. It means a lot to me and my family. And thanks for Stealthy Wealth, as I found Christia from his blog. From your number one fan, whose tax-free RA and investments are in order.
Hey, can we go home now?
It's awesome.
And the key point there is it's about informed, you know, people writing here, and we've always got opinions. I mean, our opinions, like the best in the world, yeah, absolutely. Should you always follow them?
Probably not.
But what it is helping people. I mean, because if you're just, If we're your solutions, that's no good, because one day we're on holiday. The point is to help people get to the point where they can make their own decision. They know what questions to ask. They understand the answers, et cetera, et cetera. So yeah. I think we can go home now.
So we always say that this is a show about questions. And it's always my hope that when you listen to the show, that you would be able to ask better questions of the people who try and flog their financial products on you, like if nothing else. Mm-hmm. So Antoine has some anxiety about the future and his children. And then he asked if the stock market is a Ponzi scheme, and I'll get to his mail just now. But I thought we never really discussed what the stock market is and how it works and stuff. We assume a level of knowledge about how the stock market works, and we've never actually delved into it. So let's do that today, so we have this on file. So that if you're a newbie starting listening to the Fat Wallet Show, that you can start with this one just to orientate yourself around the stock market.
So it's not really a Ponzi scheme.
So, okay, let me get to Antoine's email first. He says, a lot of traditional jobs are being taken over by technology. So he, in his email, gives a few examples, but he's like, accountants are now kind of obsolete because there's software that can do that. And your Apple Watch can do an ECG. So your doctor is becoming less and less important, which is probably a good thing, because doctors are historically very, very, very bad at making calls about your health.
General practitioner, I don't know, it's like they're practicing. They might only have got 52%.
Yeah.
Yeah. Like, I want to always see my doctor's, like, mark. Not the certificate, the mark.
So this is true for all doctors except for Wilhelm and Alex.
No, our doctors are brilliant.
Yeah. For Wilhelm and Alex and Adam.
Same with engineers. Our engineers are brilliant. The other ones, we're not so sure about you
guys. So there are three very good doctors in the world, and the rest are all So Antoine says, a bank can lend 10 times more money than is physically available in the bank.
So even more, but yes.
Out of 10 virtual rands, 9 rands are a bet on future growth and not actual value. And the same holds true for bonds and capital investments. I'm really concerned that my children will become irrelevant despite doing very well in things like maths and science. Investing in the almighty stock exchange might not save their souls. I'm hoping Simon might have something better than because it worked for 100 years, because I've heard that gospel before. So I was thinking, let's do a whole explanation of what is the stock market, what is it for, How does it work? Who are the players? How do you make money, et cetera, et cetera?
So let's go. Let's quickly step back a little bit there around the banking thing. So he is correct. Banks have depositors. So I'm a saver, so I put money in my bank, which I leave with them to save, and I earn interest on it. And I put a buck in there, and they lend out 10. Truthfully, they might lend out 100. I mean, I can't remember exactly what the capital adequacy ratios are at this point, but yes, they lend out more than they physically have on the books. The debt repayment is not so much depending on growth. It depends on the ability of people to repay that debt. But I hear his point. If we are in recessionary mode and we're not growing, and they are, whether that be locally or globally, then people can't pay the debt, and then suddenly the banks start to get into a bit of a squeeze. So, yes. So what is the stock market? I mean, So stock markets typically sprung up around mining activity commodity activity. And when I say commodity, so in the US it would be the forests that they were chopping down, or the bears and the bear skins. In South Africa it was diamonds or gold, except for the case of Pietermaritzburg, where it was just some crook who got evicted from London and went to Pietermaritzburg and started the stock exchange.
So the stock exchange starts around commodities or crooks.
Yeah, that's about right. And you know what? Frankly,
some things never change.
Frankly, the diamond miners and the like back in those days were crooks too. So they started with crooks. In our local example, we're going back to about the 1880s, and most global markets were around about that time, maybe the 1860s and 1880s. Yes, people were trading tulips in Dutchland, Netherlands, back in the 1600s, etc. So why did they start? So stock market started because me and Christia think we found a little place to mine some diamonds, and we've got some shovels, but really we want more shovels and we want more diamonds and we want to buy more lots that we can get. So we've got a little business that mines diamonds, but we want the business to be bigger so we can borrow money from friends, family, or fools, or banks. Well, it's the same thing, and pay them back, etc. But banks, particularly in this environment, are looking at this squiff and saying not interested. So what we do is we go to the stock market and we say to peeps, here's the deal. We will sell you 40% of our company for XR, and we'll take that money and we will grow the company. So we now own less of the company. We now only own 60% of it.
So in other words, we need money to grow our business, and in order to get money to grow our business, we sell a little bit of the business.
Or a lot of it, as the case may be. And we basically are no longer 100% shareholders. We are now 60% shareholders, but we own 60% of a bigger company because it's got that cash in, and a company that has, in theory, better growth prospects. There's a second reason why you list in the market. Me and you have got just one lap. We decide that we now have done everything. People can answer the Yeba Yetu questions, because I was really worried about that one. And we decide that we no longer want to own just one lap. And our friends, families, and fools don't want to buy it from us. So we list it on the JSE, on the stock market. And instead of taking the proceeds of the sale into the business, we take the proceeds of the sale into our pocket. In other words, we owned 100%, and when we finished, we only own 5% each, because we still want to get invited to the board meetings, and we now have a giant pile of cash.
Okay. So, all right. First, I want to make a point about borrowing, because you can grow a business by borrowing money, as you mentioned.
Mm-hmm.
And sometimes in the stock market, people can still borrow money.
They oftentimes do.
And we call these preference shares in the case of companies, but in the case of governments, we call it bonds.
So yes, but companies will also potentially have their own bonds. Companies which are called corporate bonds, and companies also just have debt. They'll just have an overdraft facility or a debt facility at the bank. Now, truthfully, I glibly say friends, family, fools, and bankers. Part of the reason why you might not want to borrow money is, let's take our diamond mining thing. So our business is worth $1,000, and the bank will lend us $800, you know, because that's what our balance sheet can afford. But actually, we want $5,000. So frankly, we want more than the bank will lend us.
So the question is, why would anybody buy a part of our business if we don't have the money to grow our business?
Because we have a little business which is already ticking over. And the fact that we don't have the money to grow the business is of no bearing on the growability of the business.
So it's basically, all right, so here's the way I think about it. I think as an individual, I want to be, like, some businesses make sense to me. Some businesses make more sense to me than other business. as an individual, I want to be involved in that, but I don't want to be an entrepreneur.
Mm-hmm.
So I want to buy assets that are businesses that are making money, mm-hmm. so that they can make money for me. But I don't have 10 million rand to start my own business in whatever sector. And therefore, I go and buy a tiny fraction of an existing big business.
Yeah. And you can go and buy a nice, boring, established business that probably can meet all of its future funding requirements via debt, rather than a capital raise, which would be, so for example, Discovery is launching their bank. They need capital adequacy ratios. That's going to be, say, 5 billion ZAR. I don't know what it is. Discovery could borrow that money, but what they're probably going to do is do a rights issue. In other words, sell new shares to existing shareholders to raise that 5 billion ZAR.
Okay, but I think we answered the question of the how is the stock market, yes. instead of the what is the stock market.
So we answered the how and why companies aren't. So the stock market is literally the place where, so if I've got Discovery shares and I want to buy or sell them, going and standing on that corner outside the Discovery building in Sandton and knocking on car windows and say, you got Discovery shares, is just not practical. And what happens if a person says yes? I mean, how do we know what the current price is? How do I know that if I give them money, I will really get the shares? Or how do they know that if they give me the shares, they'll really get the money? So what the stock market said is, you know what, let's have a central place where everyone can come looking to buy and sell different shares and to speculate and to invest and to trade and all of those bits and pieces. So basically, stock markets are a clearinghouse. What they do in a perfect world is they guarantee that if I buy those Discovery shares at $160 a pop, I get my shares. Or if I sell them at $160 a pop, I get my money. What they now have started to do, and when I say started, I mean 100 plus years ago, they started to add extra layers of protection. So in South Africa, we have the Companies Act, and that specifies the rules of any company list, any company registered in South Africa. You go to SIPSA, you register a PTY. There are rules around annual general meetings and shareholder rights and all of this type of stuff. What the JSC does is come and add a second layer of rules on top, a slightly more onerous. I'll give you one example. As a PTY in South Africa, once a year you have to submit results to SIPSA for what your financial results were for the year before.
Is that for tax purposes?
It's just for record purposes. SARS does have access to it, but it predates that logic. The JSC says, nice, but actually we want you to do this twice a year, and we want you to do it within 3 months of the period end. In other words, slightly more onerous, better for the shareholder. We've got a little more insight and information. If a director buys or sells shares, you've got to notify the JSC. It's, you know, it's useful. It might be meaningless, but you know, if those directors, where, you know, as a shareholder of just one lap, I can sell shares and you guys find out at the next AGM.
So what I, AGM, I love the idea that we would have an AGM of four people. What I like to think about, just to make it a bit more concrete when I think about the stock market, is I like to think about it as any other market. So a fresh produce market is a really good way for me to think about it, because it kind of illustrates who all the players are, because it really is just a market. Like, I know it seems, when we talk about shares and money and stuff, we get so weird about that sort of thing, but it actually is just...
You're 100% right. And if you go to the fresh produce and you are buying marrows, you have an expectation of what it means as a marrow. In other words, the produce market has said, this is a marrow. Those are not.
Yeah.
Gives you that level of...
So when you go to a normal market, there's the physical space, and there's a company or a person who organizes the market.
Yeah.
And in that analogy, the stock exchange is the company and the person that organizes the market. In other words, way back in the day, the stock exchange was just a physical place where you went to buy and sell shares. Like you had like little certificates and you traded them and you sold them and bought them there.
And if like me, like you lived in Durban and the stock market was in Joburg, I would phone my broker in Durban, who would phone a broker on the floor in Diagonal Street, Johannesburg, because that's where the market was.
Okay, so let's get, that's a good segue into brokers, because if the stock market is the physical place and the people who organize where the market is every week,
mm-hmm.
then a broker is a person who has a stall within the
good point
within the stock within the market. So let's say it's a fresh produce market. There's the person who organizes the market, and then there's all the farmers who come there, and all of them have a little stall, and they get to set up their fruits and vegetables there and to sell there. So you don't go to the organizer of the market to buy the fruits and vegetables. You go to the stalls to buy the different fruits and vegetables. And that's where you can start comparing prices, because this, like, presumably the input costs for fruits and vegetables is more or less the same, and you go between them and you look for quality product and whatever, and that is a broker. The stall is the broker.
And you might want fruit today, and you're not fussed which fruit. You're looking for a good priced one or a pretty one, or you might want bananas regardless of the price, or you might want bananas but only at, you know, like 20 cents each. And the farmer who's running the store, your stockbroker, again, is a licensed individual, licensed by the FSCA, formerly FSB, licensed by the JSC. They have written exams, they have compliance officers who give oversight, etc., etc. And then you get the FSPs, financial services providers. So Easy Equities is not a stockbroker, they are a financial services provider. Difference is that the JSC, if your stockbroker rips you, the JSC will step in and see you right. They audit the stockbrokers, etc., and all of that process and keep that level of compliance. FSPs don't have that, but they do have their own internal insurance in case of skullduggery or the like, and they are overseen by the FSB or FSCA, whereas a stockbroker is overseen by the JSC and the FSCA.
Okay. So if you want to buy, let's say we've now explained Simon and my gold mine, and you want to become diamond mine.
Gold's,
my bad.
Gold's useless.
I'll beehive. So if you want...
Joe, you opened that. Emails to Christia@justonelap.com.
Please don't remind me about bees. A bee came into my house and died the other day, and I was like, you know what?
Bad
just
investment.
Don't.
It's an omen.
So if you want to buy a share in Just One Lap or in our diamond mine, then you can't just go to the JSE and say, give me a share in Just One Lap. You have to go through that stall or that stock broker.
Yeah.
And that's how we think about that. So the stock market actually is just a marketplace where you can buy and sell shares through brokers.
Yeah,
and that's
shares,
really
debt instruments, derivative instruments and the like. They are these days very seldom a physical location. I mean, yes, the JSC is in Gwen Lane, Maud Street in Sandton, but it's actually electronic. There are very few what we call open outcry. New York Stock Exchange is open outcry. The Chicago Board of Options is open outcry. But the NASDAQ is not and has never been. It's always just been electronic.
Yeah, so think of it as an Etsy store then instead of a marketplace.
Yeah, that yeah.
Okay, so but why? What's in it for me going into the
stock
market?
Well, so what's in it for you is a range of product. I mean, if you just go to your local farmer and say, I need vegetables, he might only grow Brussels sprouts. Now, I mean, who doesn't love Brussels sprouts? But, I mean, how many can you really eat? So you would go to the farmer's market because you just got a bigger range. There's more vegetables. You can get Brussels sprouts and you can get, watermelon, you know, whatever it is. You can get the whole range. I can't think of a single vegetable. onions. There are onions behind you. Gem squashes. So you got the bigger range. You also got...
So in this analogy, the range would be shares.
Yeah.
In different companies.
In different companies.
So maybe don't think of shares... Think of companies. Like you can buy different companies.
Yes.
Like ownership in different companies.
You also get some protection that if I'm buying a Brussels sprout, it is a Brussels sprout and it hasn't got toxic herbicides, because this market says, you know, we're green and no toxic herbicides are possible. Will some farmers be crooks? Sure. Will some listed companies be crooks? Yeah. And hey, hello, Steinhoff, looking at you. So you get a level of protection as well from the marketplace itself. In our example, the Johannesburg Stock Exchange. And you get a third thing is you get price discovery. So if you go to one farmer and he's got Brussels sprouts and he says to you, man, these things are $100 a packet. And you're like, is that a good price? He's like, it's the price. Whereas if you're at the farmer's market and the guy says it's $100 a packet, you go 2 feet to the left and you say, well, that oak's got them at $30 a packet. Either drop your price or justify the higher price, or I buy from them. So what we get at the JSC is people want to buy our diamond mine. There's a price there. It's a quoted price. What they can also see is not just what the last price transaction was. They can see historic prices over time. Is this one going up or down? They can get information around it, you know, profitability and the like. They can also see what we call bid and offer in the central order book. A lot of jargon. Bid and offer is people who are in the market who are saying, I'm prepared to buy your Brussels sprouts at 28. And someone else says, well, I'm selling at 30. In other words, there's no transaction. People are showing their hand as to what they want to pay, and it gives you an indication. And it's like, okay, well, that 100 buck guy's really out the window because he's also in the market, and he says, I'm selling at 100. And you're like, yeah, but there's other oaks. So instead of physically having to go to the next farmer in the market, you just it's on the computer
screen.
It's
all online.
And that's your central order book. All stockbrokers, all FSPs are submitting all of their orders to the central order book. So you go to Standard Bank Online Share Trading, and I use them for an important reason rather than Easy as an example, and you can see the buyers and the sellers. That's not just Standard Bank's clients. That's everybody.
Everybody in the market.
Everybody in the world who wants to buy that particular JSE stock.
So my big issue when I started investing is I really fundamentally misunderstood what a stockbroker was, because when I was growing up, when a broker came to see you, it was normally a man who worked for Sanlam.
Yes.
You know, and I thought that a stockbroker was just a man who works for the JSE, but it's not. No. It's actually, I want to say a company, but it actually is just a computer system.
So that man from Sanlam technically was an insurance broker.
Yeah.
As opposed to Brett Duncan or at Standard Bank, who is a stockbroker.
Right, but Brett Duncan is not the stockbroker. He just runs that part of the business. Sure. The stockbroker is not a man, is my point. It's not a person.
Well, no. So there does need to be a registered stockbroker at every stockbrokerage. And remember that crazy man we saw who had a stockbroker number tattooed on his arm? You don't.
Vaguely.
Yeah. Meeting with Mark Wheatman. Not coming back. Not important. So someone at every stockbroker needs to have at least one registered stockbroker. This is a person who has written the stockbroker exams, written the registered persons exams, the relevant RPEs, is overseen by a compliance department or individual or third party who has key individuals and all of this sort of process. So there is physically a person. However, if we're a stock brokerage rather than an educational website, I could be the registered stockbroker and I can then hand off to you to actually do some transactions, etc. And I'm the overseer. So there does need to be a physical person who is registered with the JSE. Licensed, that's the word we're looking for. Okay. Who has written an exam and who has a stockbroker number.
Okay, so now we understand what the stock market is, what a stockbroker is. We understand what shares are. It's like just ownership in a company. But how do we actually make money from this?
So you own a slice of that company. So, you know, our diamond mine, we have 100 shares and you buy one of them. So now you own 1% of the company, which means you are entitled to 1% of the profits of the company at the discretion of the board. Touch on that in a moment. You are entitled to attend the annual general meeting and vote your 1% of shares on any issues that are important. One of those issues will be who's going to run the company, because we can't have 100 people running it. Those 100 people elect a board of directors who run it, who elect a CEO, and et cetera, et cetera. You make money, the company is profitable, they will take that profit, the board of directors will say, well, what do we do with this profit? They'll use some of it to upgrade the business, you know, the tractor needs replacing. They'll use some of it to grow the business. We're going to buy the farm next door, and instead of just Brussels sprouts, we'll have gem squash as well. And then they use some of that money to give back to the owners of the business, me, you, the shareholders. Now, they might not do which of those three they do is at behest of the directors.
And they can do all three, right?
Yeah, they can do all three or one of or none of. They might not make a profit. It's up to the directors as to which of and how many, etc. they will do. And that will broadly depend on the state of the company. Let's take Standard Bank. You buy shares in it. This is a giant company that makes billions of ZAR profit. They can build a new head office, they can expand their operations and still have billions of rands to give to shareholders as dividends. Flip to Purple Capital, who owns Easy, and they're a small little startup bunch. So they currently making a loss, but when they make profit, their profit will be small, and they might say to shareholders, look guys, we made a profit, and they have in past years, but actually we're not going to give you any money because it's more valuable to us in the business to grow the business, to give you a more valuable business. And that's the second way that you make money. So the first is you get a slice of the profit, dependent on the profitability of the business and where it is in its maturing stage. The other one is that it just becomes more valuable. So let's go to our diamond mine. We buy the diamond concession next door and we discover that all the diamonds there are the size of hen's eggs. And it's like, man, this is the most valuable thing in the world. Suddenly, what everyone thought we were just a bunch of diamond miners, no, we're mining the biggest diamonds in the world. And the value is bigger.
So in other words, people would pay more money to become part of our company.
Because they expect, and why would they pay more money? Because they expect the profits to be more going forward.
But the thing is, the second way to make money, you only ever make money when you sell the share. Mm-hmm. So if you can convince somebody else, so let's say you paid 100 rand to be part of our diamond mine, and you can convince somebody else to buy that share in our diamond mine now for 200 rand, you only make money once you get the money from that person. In other words, once you give up your share of the company.
You give up that share. And that we sometimes call greater fool theory. We spoke about the marijuana stocks last week that went crazy. And the greater fool theory of buying in a bubble is, can you find a bigger fool than you to sell it to for even a higher price? Now, you know, if you're buying a boring banking stock in a PE of 9 and a dividend yield of 8, you don't need any fools. If you're buying a Canadian marijuana company on a PE of 7 billion and a dividend yield of minus 12 billion, you need a greater fool to then sell that stock to.
Okay. So, and this is why people are forever poking around the stock market, because the idea is that you would find a company who over time would become more and more valuable, but that other people haven't discovered yet. So you can pick it up on the cheap, and then once it becomes more valuable, once other people become aware of it, it becomes really easy to offload those shares that you bought right at the beginning at a higher price.
Yes, broadly yes. I'll take it on one small tangent. You talk about finding the hidden gems. And let's use an example today. So my Richemont shares are down 3.7% today. What the market does is, and Warren Buffett, in fact, no, Benjamin Graham, I think, described it as a manic depressive. Sometimes the market wakes up in the morning and the world is beautiful and everything is right with the universe and shares go flying higher. Has the company done anything in the last day to make it more valuable? Yes, a little bit, but like 3%. Today, our market woke up and decided, in a manic, depressed state, decided the world was horrendous, the market wasn't our new finance minister, etc., and suddenly Richemont's down 4%. What I'm saying is that Richemont has a base value. The stock market will trade around that value. So, you know, at some point, it'll be cheaper, and you can say, Richemont's at 108, that's a good value. The market has given me opportunity because they're selling Richemont shares. Why? Well, maybe because the Rand is stronger today. So that could be the reason. Maybe Hermes luxury bags had a terrible set of results, and people are worried about the impact on Richemont. So if we take the theory that a stock has a fair valuation, I'll come to that in a second, the market will trade above and below and at different degrees above and below, giving opportunity. So, for example, I like Capitec, but at 986 Rand, it's too expensive. At 720, now I'm a buyer. Will it get to 720? Don't know. If it does, I'll buy some.
So when you said that you'll buy me a bottle of bubbles if Capitec goes over 1,000 rand, was that a once-off deal? Or was that every time Capitec goes over 1,000 rand?
Once-off deal. No, most definitely a once-off deal. The question then is, what's fair value? So you can do, you know, people use discount cash flow, DCF. People use dividend models, Gordon dividend, discount dividend models. They use DuPont methodologies. A number of different ways to do it. But even with that, let's look at the DCF, discount cash flow, which is the most popular used model. Your inputs that go into there, you've got to make assumptions on what will the margin be going forward, what will the revenue growth be, what will this, that, and all the rest. In other words, you get 100 analysts into the room, you give them, or give them Capitec and say value it. They're going to come back with 100 different answers. A lot of them might conflate within a band of, say, 800 to 900. But there'll be oaks saying this thing's worth 220, and there'll be oaks saying this thing's worth 2,220. And that's the disagreement of price in the market and why prices fluctuate Then the last point is finance ministers get fired and appointed. Moody's coming, out tomorrow, and other events that are impacting our stock market. When Brexit happened, our market went down. It's like, hang on, we're not Brexit. But just the world was like, oh, this is really, really bad. And, you know, literally within hours, we went up again. But market is responding to not only what they think the companies are worth, but also a million trillion other unimaginables.
Okay, so what does this mean for me? Because there was like, there's a lot of jargon in there, and I don't know what a discount cash flow is. How do I choose a stock? Because how many shares are there on the JSE?
450, maybe 500.
So how do I find a good one?
You don't. You buy an ETF.
Okay.
If you want to know how to find a good one, go to justonelap.com and search for Till Death Do Us. Just search for death. You'll find two posts of mine. One is about the letter for when you're dead, and the other one is my Till Death Do Us part portfolio.
Okay.
And I'm not, you know, because that is another whole rabbit hole.
That's literally like a job that people do full time.
Yes. Teams of people.
Yeah.
Yeah. Absolutely.
And that is why, personally, I prefer ETFs, because ETFs take a chunk of the market. They say, like, whatever it is, like the biggest companies or the most banky companies or whatever. And they say, we're just going to invest in all of them and divide your money between all of them.
So instead of just buying Simon and Chrystia's super awesome diamond mine, because they think, but what happened if Simon and Chrystia's run away with the diamonds? They buy 30 diamond mines, put them into a basket, and reduce your risk. So if we're the crooks, betting the other 29 aren't. But then they also say, but hang on, diamonds, like really, come on, we've got those fakey things, who needs diamonds anymore? So what they actually do is they just buy 100 shares across everything. They've got diamond mines and gold mines and bankers and grocers and everyone else. So that if not just if diamonds start, you know, if diamond mines go bust, but if diamonds go out of favor, well, you've got all the other bits in that basket to protect you.
Okay. So Christian's friends are worried about what a crash would mean for those close to retirement. He says, my friend's parents are in their 70s. They've managed their finances well. They're still able to work and live off what they earn. And they still save, which is amazing for people in their 70s.
Hey, most people don't do that in their 30s and 40s.
Exactly. He says they're worried about what the next crash might mean for their savings. What are your thoughts on the Warren Buffett approach in his will to his wife of 90% in the S&P 500 and 10% in bonds?
Yeah, so 100%, I would take even a step further. If you think that you might stop earning income, or if your income might be less than you are currently requiring, in other words, if you need to start living off the savings that you have grown over the course of your working life, if you're 5 to 10 years away from that, start extracting yourself from the stock market.
Okay, why?
Because what happens if they crash? What happens if you decide to retire on Thursday?
What is a stock market crash?
So technically 20% down in a very short period of time.
Why would that happen?
So 2008, we had all the subprime debt suddenly coming back and causing concerns. And that then went into the banks, and suddenly everyone wasn't sure if the banks were sound, and suddenly everyone just wanted out. It's like, I don't know if that bank's going to be here next week, so let me rather sell the shares and take the cash. And everyone says that, and everything just goes down. 98, it was the Asian tigers. There were some defaults happening in Asia, and that spooked the market. And in 2000,
so basically, a crash is just when a whole bunch of people see something happening in the world, and they're like, "I'm going to get rid of my shares because I'm scared my share price is going to go down." And because everybody is selling at the same time, share prices do go down, and you've just got like.
And then it becomes self-fulfilling, because you woke up this morning and thought, "Nah, I think they'll be okay," but then this afternoon they were down 10%. So suddenly people are like, "Whoa!" and they sell, and it just becomes self-fulfilling.
So, you know, often you say you should sell the dogs.
Mm-hmm.
So how do you know the difference between selling the dogs? In other words, you have a Steinhoff and it's going to shit, and a stock market crash, and you should just hold on to everything because everybody else is panicking.
It's a great question. And firstly, so Steinhoff is individual. Stock markets are, you know, the whole thing. But so how do you know Steinhoff? So Steinhoff's quite easy, right? You woke up the day and they said, are we going to issue results tomorrow, but they won't be audited? It's like, what's happening here? And then tomorrow you wake up and they say, okay, so we are not issuing any results and we fired the CEO. So at that point, you're exiting at 22 Rand. This is a stock that was once 90. You've taken serious pain. But the short answer is it's time to panic. When it is, panic quick. MTN. You wake up one day, a Monday morning, I'm on holiday, and the rumor is that Nigeria is fining them $5.5 billion US dollar, and it takes MTN 6 hours to finally get a sense out to say, no, they are, but this isn't fair. And you're like, this is I'm taking my money and running like hell.
So if I wake up and I hear that the entire market, like every single ETF that I own, is down 10%, that's probably a good sign that I should just sit tight.
Yeah, so you were an ETF investor, so don't stress it. You held Steinhoff when it happened, because it sits in, if you hold any generic large cap stocks in South Africa, it includes Steinhoff. Still includes Aspen, MTN. I mean, the litany of those stocks is growing by the day. And you do nothing. You don't worry about it, because what we know is, barring one example, every stock market that has crashed has recovered typically within 2 years. Japan,
yeah,
is the one example. And Japan is recovering. Japan is back to 1991 levels.
Yeah.
It's still half 50% down of the highs of the mid-80s. But so as a long-term investor with ETFs or with quality shares, stock market crash, yeah, maybe if anything, you've got some money sitting around and you go and buy. Of course, don't buy in the first day. You buy a little bit on day three and a little bit on, you know. And truthfully, so let's go back to 08, 09. I got a bonus in September 08. So I'm like, oh, this is the market bottom. Warren Buffett said he's buying America. So I buy shares in the market. And it falls a whole lot more. December comes and I got some money and it's like, this must be the bottom. So I buy a whole lot more. Carries on falling. March 2009, by which time some of the shares I have bought are now 50% down, I get a bonus because Standard Bank gives you half off. And I go buy more shares. And that was the bottom. And the shares that did poorly doubled in 5 years. Those are the ones that did poorly. They doubled in 5 years, which is only about 15% growth a year. But those were the laggers. And that was the Standard Bank, I thought, if I remember correctly. But stock market, if you're sitting on small caps, Dodge stocks, dogs, etc., in our current market, you should frankly be out. But if the market starts to crack, get the heck out. If you're holding quality stocks, no stress. If you're holding broad-based ETFs, okay, buy more.
So Christian's friends, parents, probably at this point, they want to start going into cash and bonds a little bit more, just because we don't know when or often why crashes happen.
I mean, our market is looking particularly fragile right now, but that is not why I'm giving the advice that I am. The answer is that if our market were to crash 50% and you're living off that investment, your living standards better be able to halve.
Yeah. Rob.
A quick rule of thumb is that 10 years out, you're 100% invested in the market, and at 0 years out, you're at 0% invested in the market. Apropos what we spoke about in last week's podcast, there's a lot of moving parts, so that's not an absolute rule, but it's sort of scale it down as you get closer.
Yeah, look, I would not, especially if you are retiring in your 70s and you expect to live another 20 years, I wouldn't go 100% out of equities.
But if you've got an annuity that's in equities to a degree or other, you're right. Mm. I mean, the idea that you would ever be 100% not in equity, I think, is a bad idea. You just want to manage what that percentage is.
Okay.
So the other rule of thumb is 100 less your age is how much equity you should have. Or some people say 120 less your age, which suggests, for this example, somewhere between 30 and 50%.
Okay.
Which is actually a good number.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So Rob is about to receive an inheritance. He says, I'm married and on the verge of starting a family. We live in a townhouse, which we're paying off. We both have RAs. We invest the max amount each month into our tax-free savings account. We are about 3/4 of the way towards having fully topped up our emergency fund. So they are in a lacquer position financially. I've also received a nice bump in my monthly pay, and I plan to invest as much of this as possible into ETFs. We do potentially want to look at buying a house, as we'll need the space with the kids, and it's nice to own somewhere with a garden. So my question is, what would be the best way to use a lump sum inheritance to ensure financial security for my growing family? Would it be a good idea to try and pay off the bond on the townhouse and then rent it out and use the money to fund a bond on the new house? Or should we buy a new house cash and rent out the townhouse as a passive income? Would it be better to keep it all under one bond? Should we just sell the townhouse and buy the house and not worry about having rental property? Or is the property idea just a bad one all around? Ooh, I think you know what you're asking
that
here,
one.
Rob.
So quick point, you can't put two properties in one bond as an individual. They want separate bonds.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
I didn't know that. I really thought that you would be able to do both.
No, because they want that bond tied to that property and stuff. And also fees, like more bonds, more fees.
But it's so weird because remember my garage has its own sectional title?
Mm-hmm.
So why don't I need a separate bond for my garage?
Probably because they fudge it and make the garage zero and the property.
Oh.
Yeah. And maybe I'm wrong, but that's certainly my understanding of it. So my short answer is own no property, that coming from a man who owns a property. what my advice would be, what I like about this question from Rob is he's thinking about it. And as we've spoken before, that lady with the dog scarf collar for $1,000 listened to last week is making decisions without thinking. Rob is sitting down and thinking, and patently has been for ages. I mean, he's got his stuff is sorted. How I would structure it is sell your current townhouse, buy another property, pay cash for it, and what you've just done is you've collapsed your monthly expenses, which means if you carry on in your current job with a nice salary increase, etc., you are saving banana loads of money. Or inversely, maybe you decide that, you know what, you don't want this job anymore, and your wife can go and earn some salary, and you're going to stay at home and raise the kids. Or maybe she stays at home and raises the kids. What it gives you is flexibility.
Yeah.
I know that the math will say is rather pay the bond off and pay it off aggressively, and you can pay it off in 7 years and all of that. So, I mean, yes. But what this does is, and it's what I did by moving to the flat. I mean, I own my flat, but the point is I own my flat. There is no bond. I paid cash for it. And my monthly expenses to live my monthly expenses to have somewhere to live, i.e. a property, went from 30 to 5, which suddenly means that, like, I don't want to do that contract anymore. I can cancel it because my monthly expenses are 25 grand cheaper.
Yeah. The thing I wanted to say about the rental property is, yes, you do receive rental income from it. But first of all, that rental income has to go, forms part of your income tax. So it's going to be taxed at your marginal rate. Secondly, you have a lot of concentration risk when you have a rental property. It is an invest. So if you like property as an investment, maybe consider a listed property instead. Because it just spreads your risk across a whole bunch of different companies, and it's still the same asset class, but you're not stuck in a physical building, in a physical place that it needs to be maintained, et cetera,
and what
et cetera.
Someone, and when I was traveling last week, someone, and I forget where, their math says that if you want to do buy-to-lets to reduce concentration risk, you ideally need 20 properties.
Oish.
But to get to economics of scale, you need 40 to 50.
Oh, my word.
Yeah.
So Rob has another question. He's like, do you pay off the debt and then worry about the investments afterwards, or do you use the money, the inheritance money that he's getting, to make an investment and use the income from the investment to pay off the debt?
It depends what the investment is, but your income might not match your debt. I would also say it depends on the debt. For example, home loans are cheap, overdrafts are not. If it's expensive debt, make it gone.
Yeah, Rob doesn't strike me as the overdraft kind of
not
guy.
Not an expensive, debty sort of person. I'm a fan of little. Again, not having debt gives you that flexibility, you know, which means, it comes back to. And we spoke about this a fair bit in last week's podcast, and we remember because we recorded it 20
minutes
ago. Well, 42, but yeah. The thing is that it gives you optionality. That's what I'm looking for. So if you've got, like, no debt, and if you own your property, and if you own your car, and all of those sort of things, if you want to work 80 hours a week and earn $10 million a year and die before you're 40, you can do that. I mean, I'm not judging you.
That's a lie, you are.
Oh, come on, let's pretend. But if you want to say to your boss, you know what, how about I only work 20 hours a week, half days, and how about I only earn a little bit less money? And it gives you that optionality. It gives you that ability to actually structure your life around your choices rather than have your life driven by your payment obligations, your debt obligations. Because a lot of people out there are working, and why are you still in this job you hate? Well, how else am I going to pay for that fancy car and 12-bedroom house and 17 billion zillion credit card because I went to the moon for my birthday and stuff like
that. Jonathan sent a really great email, and I'll read it word for word. He says, "Hi, legends.
Oh, that's us. We love you, Jonathan.
Give me a 3-minute for and a 3-minute against endowments, assuming fees aren't bad. Hooray. That was his email. That's all of it.
Well, okay. So assuming fees aren't bad.
What is an endowment? I didn't even know.
So an endowment is a policy from the 80s where they used to basically pillage poor people who thought they were buying a good thing. So you put money in, usually a lump sum, sometimes a monthly contribution, usually a lump sum, and it spits out the other end a return that is now tax-free and supposedly a great return that is also tax-free. If you put money in the current, what ABS is giving, 13% asterisks, I don't know what the T's and C's are, but that 13% is you know, it's interest and therefore has tax implications depending on all sorts of issues. So an endowment, I mean, so what's the benefits of an endowment? So it's a guaranteed product. If it'll give you a guaranteed return over a period of time, and it'll be devoid, you know, no tax to be paid on the other end. So an endowment might only give you 10%, and you say like, hey, ABS is 13, but if you're in the bracket where you pay tax on interest, then that 13 is effectively maybe only 9, as an example. So the benefit is a fixed guaranteed return. Your risk is twofold, that the institution who sold it to you lied about the good fees. The institution that sold it to you goes belly up, because I don't know what the protection is. I don't know the structure and the like. And the risk is that you get a return that you could have got far superior somewhere else. Be very, and look, I haven't looked in an endowment in 30 years, ever since someone sold my then 22-year-old sister a 30-year endowment.
Whoa.
And she was making monthly contributions. No, she was being clever. She was like, so I'm 22, I'll have a kid when I'm 32, so this will pay for my kid's varsity fees. I mean, yeah, no, spot on. Except that the first 6 years of contributions went
were
to costs.
Fees. Oy.
No, were fees, and then there was still tail of fees. This was fees and costs to brokers and everything else. Now, apparently, and Jonathan seems to suggest that fees are not so bad. Yeah. Okay.
Look,
I don't
just,
know.
It sounds to me, Jonathan, that you want to familiarize yourself, maybe spend a day or two on the T's and C's of whatever endowment you're getting into before you get into it.
And understand they're not an investment product. They, you know, if you're looking
for, is it more like a capital protection type of product?
Exactly.
Okay. Tim wants to claim back a loss from SARS. Shame, it sounds like he's had some hard times. He says, I invested into a scheme that now appears to be a fake scheme. In other words, the money is not getting paid out. Am I able to get to claim the loss against my tax return? If I'd made a profit, SARS would have asked for their share. So surely the inverse must also work. It's such a lovely thought.
Your logic is sound, but I think the answer is no.
And he says, if so, what proof would I need to substantiate this? So now, if you were going to pay income tax on the profit that you made from this investment, you can claim back a loss. If you were going to pay capital gains tax on the profit you made from this investment, you can't claim back the loss. And the trouble that you're going to have, Tim, is you're going to need to prove that you were going to pay income tax.
But hang on a second here. I hear what you're saying. I think you're right. But here's my splinter in the wood pile. If it's a scam, it's a crime. If I'm a victim of crime, let's say I get my wallet stolen and there's $1,000 in it. I can't say to SARS at the end of the year, hey, had my wallet stolen.
Oh my word, that would be so amazing. That would be so amazing.
I would lose my wallet 4 times a day.
Do insurance companies do that? Do they claim back losses from SARS?
Insurance companies? Mm. Well, what they would do if they make a loss, they just don't pay any tax and then that loss is rolled into next year's profit.
Oh.
So they don't claim it back, but they get
technically they get the credit.
So my issue is that is this a out-and-out scam, in which case I don't know. I don't know that you can claim it.
I think it depends on the product. He did say that he's going to share his story. Luckily, it was only money that he put into it, but he did say he was going to share the story for it.
Yeah, so I mean, yeah, let us know what the answer is. I it might be tricky.
Okay. Alexander has questions about investing for minors. So he wants to know what would happen if family members contributed to a tax-free savings account for a minor and accidentally hit the 33 limit. Like, who would be liable for that tax? He says, would the platform block the transaction? I use Easy Equities. Easy Equities actually do in the tax-free account. If you want to go over, they block the transaction. He says, or would someone be liable to pay a fine presumably the legal guardians of the child.
Correct.
All right.
And so the legal guardian of the child, any money over $33,500, but it's $33 a year, the fine is 40% of any monies over $33,000, and it is the legal guardian of the child, and obviously when the child's a major. Is it a major? An adult. No. it's then their liability.
So when your kid goes from a minor to like in the army in one in one birthday,
sounds about right. And some platforms do block, but I'm not sure about that necessarily. I don't know. Remember also that you have that you are being donated to, and there are tax implications on donations too.
For the guardian.
Mm.
So he says it seems better to have a bank account that people can.
Yes.
Yeah, that does make more sense. Then he wants to open an investment account for his godchild, but not a tax-free savings account. He says, how would tax around this work? If anything is withdrawn before the child can be a registered taxpayer, would the parents be responsible for the tax liability or him?
The guardians, so the parents.
So if you like the kid but not the parents, this is an awesome thing to do.
But here's the thing. So, I mean, I've been giving money to my niece and nephew for years and years. It's done nothing. Thank you, Christia. So there has thus far been no tax to pay. So not true, some dividends, but that's taxed at source. You never see that money. And there's been no tax to pay because there's been no taxable events, which in English means you've never sold anything.
Okay. Shaunton wants to know if the 27.5% rebate would apply to him if he works for himself. So if he owns his own business or if he's an independent contractor, would the 27.5% still apply?
Yeah.
Yeah.
So here's the question, and I'm not sure of, does it apply to your income before costs or your income after costs? Because if you work for yourself, you earn a million, but you spend 200,000 generating that million, so you pay tax on 800. So I think it applies on the 800.
So I had an even bigger hack, possibly. You know, companies who contribute to the pension funds of their employees get a tax benefit for contributing to the pension fund of their employees.
That's why they do it. They don't like you. They like saving money.
Yes. So if you work for yourself, depending on what kind of company you have, if you pay 27.5%, you can get on an individual level the tax rebate for that. But if you contribute from your company side into your pension fund, you could also get a tax rebate there, can't you?
I don't know.
Double tax benefit?
No. I can tell you that the words double tax benefit do not exist.
They do if you invest in an RA and then in a TFSA. I have hacked the system, my friend.
Yes, you are right. There is one loophole. You have found it. The odds of there being two unicorns is zero. Because think about it. If there are two unicorns, there'll be thousands of them because they're breeding, right? There's only one unicorn.
But
you have it.
I think Shaunton should look into it. Like, if you have a PTY and a PTY that contributes to pension fund of an employee, and you're an employee of your own PTY, and you've got the 27.5, look into it. Why not?
Yeah, look into it. Do all the math of PTYs. There's definitely some benefits, but there are some costs involved as well. And
actually, go onto justonelap.com. Go check out our Tax Tuesday blog, because our tax elves wrote an article about when PTY is more tax beneficial than not.
Yeah.
Bongani is concerned about capital appreciation due to rand depreciation. In other words, he is worried about paying too much tax when the rand tanks. He says, rand depreciation means capital gain for me as a South African investor on dollar-based ETFs. So can we explain what that means quickly before we carry on?
So dollar-based ETFs, I mean, he's talking about offshore, literally New York-listed ETFs. Yes?
No. He's talking about like Ashburton 1200, dollar-denominated.
Okay. Dollar-denominated. So what happens there is the Ashburton 1200 is at $50 and the rand crashes like from 14 to 28, which means that immediately that ETF just doubles in value. Boom. Because,
why?
Well, because what you do is you take your ZAR, you turn it into dollars, and then you buy the 1200 companies. Now, if that dollar, ZAR dollar exchange rate goes from 14 to 28, well, then the value of those ZARs doubles in value. So without any movement in the index, it would double in value. It's why we will see, I mentioned earlier, my Richemonts are down. Part of that is because they're actually priced in Swiss francs, I think it is, and then they come back to South Africa in rand. So because the rand is stronger today, it's less attractive. So he would then be liable for that 100% gain when he sold. Yes, it would be taxable.
Okay. He says, what if I were to invest in a JSE listed ETF? Or what if I buy the MSCI World ETF from Vanguard as an offshore investment? What about the rand depreciation then?
Then not.
Why?
Because SARS says you've taken the money offshore, and I'm assuming you've done it legitimately. You've moved the money offshore. The moves in the currencies are not taxable.
But you are bringing back more money than you took out.
Then we get into that fuzzy area.
Yeah.
So this is the debate we had about a while ago. Now I can't remember. I'm getting old. I can't remember what the answer was around that whole concept of, well, hang on a second. If you buy it in the US, in US dollars, you don't have the currency impact. You only have the dollar impact. But I'm not convinced that's necessarily true.
And
I remember a Standard Bank presentation about WebTrader that your profit was determined on both currency move and share price move.
What happens when you bring currency into the country? Because that's really the answer. Because if you take it out, like what you do with it when it's overseas is irrelevant. Like whether you invest it in the stock market or like gamble it away or whatever.
The honest answer is I don't know, because I haven't ever. So because here's the challenges around it. So you don't take currency out just once. You take currency out every 6 months over a 10-year period. You've got an average price. What's your average price? I mean, did you calculate this? Has your bank calculated it? The answer to both is no. When you bring the money back again, I mean, what happens if you've actually lost money? So you took out a million ZAR, but you were a bad investor, and now it's only half a million ZAR. And you took it out at an average of 12. If you bring it back at 14, does SARS say, well, you've made $2 on the currency, pay us that too? Because how do we know what the average is?
But does SARS charge for bringing currency in? That's the question. Like,
so everyone I know who's bought currency back in has done it in a dodge way, and they've got a very scary letter from SARS.
This is a really interesting question because
we need a tax off.
Because presumably, look, it's not going to be capital gains tax because you're taking out rands and you're bringing in rands, right? You're taking out rands, turning it to dollars, then you're taking the dollars, turning it into rands.
Well, it wouldn't be income tax.
Yeah, because it's just a currency move.
Yeah.
So you're just bringing in more currency than you took out.
Which is why I think the currency move is neutral, which is why a lot of folks say they want to buy it in the US rather than in South Africa, because in that doubling in the price due to the rand halving in value, doubling from 14 to 28, doesn't impact. However, remember that having assets in the US now means you need a will in the US and all of those levels of...
You know who would know the answer to this?
Yeah.
Patrick Mackay.
But he's on holiday.
Okay, Patrick, when you come back from holiday, please answer Bongani's question because we don't know.
Or our tax elves.
Or our tax elves. Corbus wants to know if higher tiers are worth higher rewards. He says, I'm trying to compare reward programs of different credit cards. Is it worthwhile to go for a higher tier status just so you can get a bigger rebate on petrol? It seems that there is not one reward program that's the best. Rather, one is good for one thing and one is good for another thing. Is it best to just ignore these programs altogether?
Look, that can be so my answer is Excel, right? I mean, is it better to pay for the higher reward because of petrol? Well, it depends how much petrol you buy and how much you get back and what does it cost you to get that higher reward, and is it convenient? For example, my reward says I got to buy petrol at a Caltex. I haven't seen a Caltex since the 70s. Remember the rabbit?
Mm.
I mean, like, when else did you see a white rabbit? It's a calculation, and some of them are useful. I mean, for example, the incredibly expensive year-end holiday, I managed to get flights using my Voyager miles. But now I actually travel a lot, and I've got a high-cost Amex card, which I expend. Blah blah blah. It's a formula. You need to run the math.
Look. So here are the things that you need to think of. The first thing you need to think of is, what is your monthly fee to have, first of all, the card, and secondly, the reward program? Because for Vitality, for example, like, I thought you just joined Vitality, but you don't. You pay a fee to belong to Vitality.
How
much? 200 and something rand. So you it costs you money to sometimes belong to a reward program, and then you have to have the account. So if you've got a credit card, you pay the credit card account, and then you might also pay to belong to the reward program. So you need to go run the numbers, Quivers. You need to go see how much the accounts are going to cost you. And don't fall for this, because when I applied for my home loan, F&B said they'll give me a better interest rate on my home loan if I go to a certain account of theirs, and it turns out the interest rate that they gave me, the cost of the account was more than the interest rate saving that they gave me over 20 years. which is insane.
And you're in the maths. I mean, I've got a very expensive Amex card, and we discussed this before, because it gets me lounge access, etc. But that then also earns me miles, which then feeds into my Voyager account, which then gets me free flights.
Do you have to pay for the Voyager account?
No, the Voyager is free. The Amex card is very expensive. But my wife and I just got, you know, like we're flying to Joburg, Cape Town over festive season for 264 Rand.
But considering the cost of the car, I'm assuming you've run the numbers.
Yeah, so for me, and the cost of the card is that I go through airports about 40 times a year. So I visit a lounge about 40 times a year. The cost of those lounge accesses is 100 to 300 a pop. So I'm paying 4,000 to 10,000 for lounges. The card only costs me 2,000.
But don't you think you're making a... like you're not comparing really apples with apples? Because what you get...
You want me to go sit with the people.
I want you to go to the Mug and Bean like the rest of us. Like, what is lounge access? Like, I know that you're not a big eater, for example.
Oh, no. You must see me at the lounge. Bacon cheese croissant.
So, yeah, but still, a bacon cheese croissant at
Mug and Bean
is like 60 Rand or whatever.
And a cappuccino.
So let's say it's 100 bucks.
So my lounge access is costing me 50 bucks a pop. No, I mean, I ran the numbers. So aside from the fact that I don't want to have to sit in these crowded Mug and Beans, and also I'm a smoker, so I want a ventilated smoking space, and that cuts down at the airports where I can go, etc. and the like, just on pure math, I'm paying about 50 bucks. Now, I could go sit in those terribly uncomfortable chairs that are free, and day free, but my the trick is I get to airports early because I have a phobia of missing a flight, and I then work.
Okay.
Yeah.
All right.
So I'm using their free Wi-Fi. I'm eating. And you must also know how many. I'm not a big eater, but like bacon and cheese croissant at the SAA lounge in Joburg, man, I can eat a lot.
You know what's cool about this question? We get so many questions where the answer is it depends. But in this case, you can really just run the numbers. Yeah. And there's going to be a numerical value at the end of this question. You're going to be like, okay, yeah, this is what it's actually going to cost me to have this program.
And I got this card, I think it was 2006, maybe 2005. And back in those days, I mean, there was a time when I was doing like 80, 90, 100 flights a year.
Ugh, it sounds awful.
No, it was, trust me. But yeah, you know, and that's why I revisited it this year. Because I'm like, hang on, I'm not doing as many trips as I used to. I need to make sure this still works, and it does.
Okay.
And there will be a tipping point where I no longer fly, and then it's like, you know what, actually suck it up. If you're only doing three trips a year, well, then pay the 300 bucks and it's cheaper.
Yeah.
Or go to Mug and Bean.
Go to Mug and Bean.
Well, look, I own the shares. I should, like, no. Yeah.
Oh, my word, the coffee is so bad there.
I know.
It is so bad. Like, you can't imagine that somebody would make all their money from
coffee
so bad at it.
If you're at the airport lounges, is they all have these machines that make what they call coffee. It's not what I would call coffee. And people queue up to get these instant horrible cappuccinos and shit. And if you go to the bar, they've got a real cappuccino machine and a real person makes you a tasty one.
Okay. Top tip from the Just One Up team this week. All right, that's it from us this week. Remember, please, that this is a show about questions. Send yours to ask@justonelap.com. You can also join the Fat Wallet community group on Facebook. Thank you so much to Aidan Whitaker for managing that, being our community wizard. My name is Christy van Heerden. Thank you to Simon Brown. We'll catch you again.